It's 9 o'clock, and I want to get started because I want to finish up today. Let me and I want to focus on Revar and Cutler without getting into too many distractions, so we can be sure to finish today. But I do want to reply because one of the listeners asked me, "You get a full hour. You might get more than a full hour. I got to finish everything I need to do." But one of the listeners said to me that he looked on Herman. We spoke a lot about Herman Wouk last class, and he looked on the Wikipedia page, and I'm looking on it right now, and there's nothing about Yeshiva University, and he wanted to know whether it's true that Herman Wouk taught at Yeshiva University. He absolutely did teach at YU, and he taught English at Yeshiva University in the 50s. If you look around, you'll find it, but it's I don't know why it's not on the Wikipedia page. That's Someone has to put it on the Wikipedia page. And for those who were not here last class, here is what Herman Wouk looks like today at 102. And he published a memoir last year. So there he is. Okay, let's just pick up exactly where we were. Put Revaron back on the screen. I spoke a little bit at last week his involvement in Israeli politics. So let me pick up with that by saying, first of all, he wasn't Satmar. He wasn't anti-Zionist in the Satmar type of anti-Zionist sense. I mentioned last class that he spoke before the chaplains in the Israeli army. I said he was invited there probably by Rav Gorin, and that's really how he ended the class last time. He, though, as I said, though, as class, he was very involved. One of the things he was very involved with, and we'll see Rabbi Soloveitchik's role in a minute, was what they call the Chinuch Atzmai, the Agudist Orthodox school system, which is separate from the government. He actually thought that all the religious schools should be separate from the government, and he suggested in a speech that he gave in Lakewood to the RCA convention, was that both Mizrahi and Aguda should join together and create an educational system. And he even suggested that the person who should the people should be in charge of it would be three people: Rav Herzog, chief rabbi; Gelman, he was head of one of the leaders of Mizrahi; Aryeh Leib Gelman, and Rav Zalman Sarotzkin from the Aguda. So here is Rav Aaron Cutler suggesting that the Mizrahi and the Aguda create a joint educational organization because he was very afraid that the government would have influence if it was involved with the school. As far as I know, it never really happened that way until much later. For all the years, I can't recall it ever there being an issue of the Israeli government telling the Orthodox school systems what they need to teach. It's only been in the last few years with the Hesder system, where the government said that they're teaching extremism and things like that, that the government tried to get involved. And also with the Haredim, with the secular studies, the thing they call Liba, trying to push that. But that took many decades. But you know, the Talmud says that the Chacham is one who roes hanolad, he sees what's coming. So even the Aguda system never was independent. The whole Aguda school system is funded by the government. Now, this speech that Rav Aaron Cutler gives in Lakewood, he's invited. The RCA was having a convention in Lakewood, as I mentioned. It was a resort area, so he's invited to give a speech there. This is in the 1950s when Rav Soloveitchik was in Mizrahi. He was supposed to give a halachic shiur. That's why they invited him. They weren't inviting Rav Aaron to speak on hashkafa, on philosophy or politics, because he's an Agudistan and they're Mizrahi. So it was quite controversial what he spoke about. And during his speech, he criticizes Mizrahi because Mizrahi made it clear that they were going to remain in the government no matter what. And Mizrahi said that's the only way to secure religious education. And that's why Rav Aharon said, no, we can have our own educational system without being involved in the government. During the speech, we have someone who recorded what happened during the speech. One of the RCA rabbis, we don't know who, got up and said to Rav Aharon, that Rav Aharon, what you did is wrong. You're not a member of the RCA, and therefore you have no right to speak to us about what RCA policy, Mizrahi policy should be. The RCA is in line with Mizrahi. He said that you were invited here to give a halachic shiur, and therefore that's what you should have done. And Rav Aharon shot back that what he spoke about is pikuach nefesh, as matters of life and death, spiritual life and death. And how can anyone object? But the RCA took a vote, and they voted not to accept Rav Aharon's recommendation. That is, not to accept his plan that they tried to organize a school system independent of the government. It would be very difficult. They'd have to raise the money, or maybe some of the money could go into a special fund, which they then can use, but without any government involvement. But Rav Aharon said that he wanted it to be self-sufficient and supported privately with no involvement from the government at all. So in theory, at least, that was his idea. Now, in the Sarosky book, page 2, volume 2, page 123, it refers to a certain rabbi here. It doesn't tell us who the rabbi is, but I'm telling you it's Rabbi Emanuel Rachman. Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, who during this period was a leading, not just a leading figure in American Orthodoxy, he was also a rabbi in the Fifth Avenue Synagogue for Shari in Far Rockaway, Shari Tefillah, and Fifth Avenue. He was second in command at Yeshiva University. He only goes to Israel when he doesn't become president, when Norman Lamm is elected president. He's also president of the RCA for a time, and he is the major antagonist in the modern Orthodox world against Rav Aharon Cutler. So in the Sharosky book, it records, this is quoting Rabbi Miller from Toronto, that one of the leading speakers at the RCA convention said to Rav Aharon, it will not help you, Rav Aharon. Your Cutlerism has no chance of succeeding in America. And then Sarosky says, but time will tell. It's Dafka, his viewpoint, which conquered America in the next generation. Rachman would refer to Rav Aharon's position as Cutlerism. And he wrote against what he called Cutlerism. Anyone who was around at that time knows what Cutlerism is. And it's not a positive way of referring to it. And in a sense, Sharosky's right. I mean, the form of Judaism, if you were in the 1950s and you had to predict what things would look like 50 years later, there's no question in your mind that the orthodoxy that would survive. And from the 1950s, there wasn't going to be much orthodoxy because the best and the brightest were leaving orthodoxy and going to conservative. If you look at the JTS's classes, most of the rabbis were coming out of Yeshiva College. It really was not the era of expansion for Orthodoxy. On the contrary, it was the era of movement to the suburbs, the great expansion of the conservative movement. But the Orthodoxy that would survive, everyone would have said in the 1950s, would have been precisely the Lukestein, the Rachman type of modern Orthodoxy, which is very acculturated, or like Aaron Cutler might say, assimilated, but very acculturated. This was the era of fitting in, of the melting pot. Of course, how things changed in 50 years. Rav Aharon was also very much involved in the battle against women being forced to do not just army service, but then later the Sherut Leumi. Originally, the plan was that the women who would get an army exemption would be obligated to do national service. And at first glance, why? How could anyone object to national service? I mean, you're helping out in a hospital, you're doing something like that. And for the religious Zionist, the Sherut Leumi, the national service then and today, has always been regarded as very important, very selfless, and it's completely voluntary. All the girls who go to national service, and in the religious Zionist world, the ones who don't go to the army, they exclusively, almost all go to national service. It's all volunteer. There's, because the Haredim, they weren't called Haredim then, but the right wing, they oppose national service because, again, of a fear that once you give the government control, if you say, well, the girls don't go to the army, so the government's then going to determine you go work here, go work there, that they can't have. And therefore, there never was a law mandating national service. Now, Navarro's opposition to national service even included being part of a mass rally in New York. Now that gets us into the really tricky thing because he was accused of going to the Goyim, bringing Jewish disputes public to the Goyim. This is something we see with Satmar. I don't know if you've heard that Satmar, on the 70th anniversary of the State of Israel, coming up very soon, Satmar is going to have this mass rally, this anti-Israel rally. Now, what I think the problem is here is because if you're going to oppose BDS, as you should oppose BDS, then how could you not oppose Satmar? And it's a big problem because BDS can then say, well, we're not anti-Semitic and we're not this, we're not that, because Satmar says the same thing. And Satmar does say the same things. And so here you have a big organization, Satmar, which is the largest Hasidic group in America, in the world. And they're going to have a rally in Manhattan opposing the existence of the State of Israel. I mean, what could be more of a Chilul Hashem, and what could be more undermining of the State of Israel in today, when we have all, these other organizations, these so-called progressive organizations, trying to delegitimize the State of Israel, when you have guys with long beards and payas filling the squares. But they've done that in the last few years with regard to the army numerous times. Rav Aaron was also involved in the battle in 1958 against the opening of a swimming pool, a mixed swimming pool in Jerusalem. They didn't have many hotels or any, but this is going to be a public pool. And again, he was challenged that you're hurting the State of Israel. And he replied as follows. This is on page 144 in Sarosky. He says, no, I'm not hurting the State of Israel. I'm giving it strength because if we make it a more religious place, that'll strengthen the State of Israel. And by removing, Torah violations, all these things, the army for women, et cetera, he says that, these things are the biggest danger. So unlike the Satmar, which is opposed to the state, Rav Aaron says that everything I'm doing, and if it's going to require public protests to get the State of Israel to change certain policies, I'm actually helping the State of Israel and helping it become more secure because God will smile on it, that sort of thing. He also was very opposed. Remember, if you recall a few classes ago, Rav Aaron was one of the few in the Aguda who opposed the creation of a State of Israel. In practice, not in theory, he agreed with the Satmar position then that the State of Israel would be run by the Zionists and it would, terrible things would happen to traditional Judaism. But once the state is established, and so once Jews are living there, then you have to be a supporter of it. And that was the position of all the anti-Zionists, so with the exception of the Satmar and their group, especially because for people like Rav Aaron, it was never a theological objection to a State of Israel. The objection was that the non-religious Zionists, the secularists, would control matters and they would persecute the Orthodox, which happened to a certain extent, a little bit, but never really happened the way he thought. But if all the Zionists were religious and it was going to be a religious state, then he would have had no problem, nor Rav Elchanan Wasserman. It's the Satmar that has this theological problem that until the coming of the Messiah, Jews have to be in exile and wanderers. It's just like what the Vatican's position always was, that the Jews, like the curse of Cain, that the Jews have to wander from place to place until, from the Catholic position, it was until they recognize the truth of Jesus, then they can, return to the land as Christians. And the Satmar position is until the coming of the Messiah. So once the state is established, Rav Aaron then becomes a big supporter of involvement, religious involvement to try to change laws and other things. And he responds to the Satmar position. Not just the Satmar position, the whole, this goes back to the whole Hungarian approach, where the Hungarians had this ideology of not just separating from Zionism, separating from the non-Orthodox. Whereas, as we know, in Poland and Lithuania, you only had single communities. Every community in Poland, let's say, or in Lithuania, you had the Orthodox, you had the non-Orthodox. And they fought it out in, and on the community boards, community elections, you would have Orthodox, you'd have Bundists, you'd have socialists, you'd have everything. But they all agreed that you do it together. And And that's what he has a letter in which he says in Lithuania and in all of Poland, all the great rabbis agreed it was with, he said, without exception, that you have to vote in the various elections. And even he says in places where it was clear that the majority would be irreligious, and that was in many of the big cities, nevertheless, he says, the great rabbi said you have to fight for every seat. And that's exactly what the Aguda and the other parties did. They fought to get into the city government because to save what you can save. And from the Lithuanian perspective, the Satmar idea of separatism, of not being involved in the government, it made absolutely no sense. He says that this is the position of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, of Meir Simcha of Divinsk, of Reb Chaim Ozer, Grzinski. And then he says that even for the Satmar people, the Hungarians, he says, who in their times made separate communities, even they should see that in the state of Israel today, there's no such thing as separate communities. The whole concept doesn't make sense. There's one country, and you got to be involved in the country to help the religious community. Rabbi Shach once said, in trying to show how the Satmar position makes no sense, he says that if you're walking down the street and you're carrying a bunch of apples and you trip and all the apples fall and people start grabbing, trying to steal your apples, grab the apples. If you stand there and start screaming and saying, "Ay, gewalt, all my apples are being taken," you're an idiot. You're losing out. Instead, you should get down on the ground and try to grab as many apples you can get. And he said, that's the same problem with the Satmar. They're screaming about how the people run the state are irreligious, and they're screaming gewalt and nothing's happening. Instead, they should try to get down and grab the apples, try to grab as much as they can, get Knesset seats, try to have influence. And that was the mainstream position also of the people who came out of, as I said, even the Hungarians, the Babov, the Vizhnitz, the Belzers, all these types, these were anti-Zionists before the war. But once the state is declared, you'd be anti-Zionist now, you live in the country. Rav Aharon even went as far to say that the Brisker Rav, Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, who was not involved in politics at all, and some of the things he said really sound a lot like Satmar, that he was planning on coming out of in support of the Aguda, but then he passed away. Now, the Eda Charedit said that this is nonsense, it's a lie, but a letter from the Brisker Rav appears after his death, and its authenticity is affirmed by his sons. And this is a revised version of an earlier letter he wrote in Brisk telling people they have to vote, and therefore he told people in Israel they have to vote. And I showed you last week. This picture. On one of his trips to Israel, Rav Aharon meets, that's Moshe Sharett on the left, and we said that that's Moshe Sharer in the back. And so he met with them to discuss these matters. Now, Rav Aharon was also very involved in Chinuch Atzmai. Chinuch Atzmai is the Aguda school system, which was established and was given basically independence from the Israeli government. And a budget, but they wanted to raise more money, and they always had to raise more money for their programs. This is a—it's really—I don't even think in the beginning they got as much money as the regular school system, the Mizrahi school system, which was a Zionist and which was part. The argument made was that by the rabbis in Israel who disagreed with Rav Aharon that you have to be totally separate from the government because that's impractical, is that they pay taxes too. Remember, in those days, the Agudistan paid taxes. If you look today, the numbers of taxpayers in the Haredi community is way out of whack with their population because half the people don't work. But in those days, everyone worked and they paid taxes. And even today, you could say you pay sales tax when you buy things. The Chinuch Atzmai school system was established. Yaakov Katz said that it's one of the worst things that ever would happened. Because he said that Israel is the only country in the world that funds a school system which does not teach the civic values of the state. I mean, if they want to have their own school system, like the Satmar, they have it, but the Aguda is funded by the government, but they don't teach Zionism and they don't teach identification with the national narrative, I guess you could say. Jacob Katz writes this in his autobiography. much Israel was a very poor place. Much of the money raised for the school system was raised right here in the United States. They used to have dinners every year where wealthy people would give money, which would then be sent to Israel. They did this in Europe as well. And Rav Aharon was the leading figure in Chibud Chatzmai. And in 1956 or 55, he asks Rabbi Soloveitchik if Rabbi Soloveitchik will chair the 1956 Chinuch Atzmai dinner. Now, Rav Soloveitchik is not just a member of Mizrahi, he's the leading figure in Mizrahi, Religious Zionists of America. And there's a lot of negative feelings towards him in much of the yeshiva world because it's not just like he was Mizrahi, he was a member of Aguda. Not only was he a member of the Aguda, in the early 1940s, he was on the presidium of their Council of Torah Sages. Even though he's quite young, he wasn't even yet 40, but he was on their Council of Torah Sages. And then by the end of the war, he has left Aguda, and he publicly gives a speech explaining why he left Aguda. And the answer was the Holocaust. The Holocaust showed him the importance of the state and that Jews need to be able to stand up for themselves. The old model of the Shtadlan, of trying to work behind the scenes, clearly had failed. And his argument is that the Holocaust showed us that we need a state. But he never became a Zionist like Rav Herzog or Rav Kook or any of the others. But he was a Zionist. And as time went on, he wrote some of the most important Zionist essays. And yet Rav Aharon Cutler asks him if he will attend, if he will chair this meeting. And chairing the meeting also means raising funds for it and bringing his lay people, his balabatim, because if he's the main spokesman, main speaker at the meeting, then many of his followers, and remember, his followers are all Mizrahi people and Rav Soloveitchik. They're the Mamachti Dati, they're the religious Zionist school system in Israel. And yet, when Rav Aharon asked him, Rav Soloveitchik, how could he say no? And not only does he not say no, he comes to this meeting and he gives a very famous speech. I want to play you 2 minutes of the speech, and those who don't know Yiddish, my Yiddish, I understand maybe half of it. There's an English, you can see the English translation under it. I think you can get a sense also of Soloveitchik was said to be the greatest darshan, the greatest sermonizer of his day. And you'll see here, I picked the part, the most famous of the parts of the speech. So let me see if I can, I have a button here that I can supposedly give you the screen. So I'll play 2 minutes of this. I believe you can see this screen now, so I'm going to play it for you.
Eine verständige Schwachheit zu dem Augenblick. Ich öffne sich mit ihm, ohne dass er sein Geschmack. Wenn ich für seine Anwesenheit fühle ich in mir ein Gefühl von Kreis. Nun wird der Mann mich und ich denke, es ist weit. Etwas, da kenne ich in ihm, wie Jesse von der Konte Juden, welches jener ist geworden und gemerkt, und hat gesagt, mit Beis Abo, er gehört zu der Beis Abo. Etwas in ihm rät, und ich da mir vor, und am Morgen rät, er wisse, wer ist gern mein Auto sei. Etwas in ihm rät, und ich da mir vor, Und am Morgen redet er sam sicher mit Rabbi Kneger. Aufregen ist beides Schwerin und Verlangen für jene Machreis. Und wenn ihr so bis aber mehr nicht als ein Teire noch, da wir sind ein Gott und die Friede der Jador. Oder zu sein ein Gott ist noch Teire wenig. Die Qualität von Agobo ist Gutstere, Erfahrenheit, Chamines, ist Labes, Leidenschaft, ist Beides. Behebe mis Chalim, leuron, schon tamir, hafamim. Genießen Sie Ihr Licht noch wenig! Kalte Kehle, die kalte Luft ist noch nicht.
Okay, so I'm back. Hope you could all hear that. Let me stop sharing the screen and put your volume back up there. So you see the Soloveitchik, how he speaks so positively about Revaron, and he thinks of his grandfather, and he when Revaron's speaking, and and this was a big deal. And if you listen, if you're interested, you listen to the whole speech. It's really about Revaron. But because Revaron asked him to do this, and he says this, even though he disagrees with Revaron on Okay, everyone. I'm sorry. Obviously, we have a problem. When I tried to go to the screen, I showed you, you watched the video, but you couldn't see anything else. So that's a, after you heard Soloveitchik, you couldn't hear anything else. So I'm assuming the last thing you heard was my discussion with Rav Soloveitchik. And what I said then afterwards, now you have time, correct? Now you can hear, right? Okay, I finished the video. Yeah, unfortunately it's that. And this is my my computer here, with which is wireless. So hopefully I'm going to get back on the other one. I have to restart it because it froze for me as well. But let's continue here. What I said after that was that Rav Soloveitchik, who was not an Agudistan, was still able to, because Rav Aaron asked him, was able to show great respect for Rav Aaron and come to that dinner and give an amazing speech. And Rav Aaron was able to show great respect for Rav Soloveitchik, even though, as I said, they disagreed. And that's a very important thing. Here, I'm going to try to transfer us in a minute to the other computer. I then showed you the pictures. There's a famous picture of Irving Bunim and Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Aaron. Here it is. At the Chinuch Atzmai dinner. Unfortunately, when this picture was recently reprinted, the author cut out Rav Soloveitchik's picture. If you've seen my book, you know that story. And the author really must think that his people in Lakewood or wherever else are real idiots, because supposedly he was asked why he's not alive anymore, so I don't want to mention his name, but he was asked why he did this, and supposedly he said because people will see the picture and get the wrong idea. Now, what's the wrong idea? They'll see the Rav Aaron was sitting with the Rav and will think he can go to YU or something. I mean, the whole thing's crazy. What he's saying basically that his people are so unsophisticated that they can't appreciate that great Torah sages can have differences of opinion but can still respect each other and be friendly and work together for common causes even without agreeing on everything. The idea that you can't see Rav Aaron together with the Rav is crazy. My computer restarted again, so while we're speaking, I want to try to get us on the other one again, because I'm afraid I'll lose you since I'm wireless here. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is, because only 6 years later, Rav Aaron passed away young, at age 71 in 1962, and unfortunately, the funeral showed some of the negative trends that we see with the censorship of the picture of Rav Soloveitchik. What do I mean by that? You know, Rav Aaron always had great respect for Rav Soloveitchik. This doesn't always carry on to the students. And in the yeshiva world, as you know, Rav Soloveitchik was known as JB. I'm sure many of you know that. Incidentally, I'm going to keep this on right now because we only have about a half hour left. If I lose me on this wireless, then I'll go right to my wired and I'll connect immediately. The problem with the wireless is that even if it loses it for a second, a quarter of a second, then I lose the connection and it's no good. And let's just leave it here for now. Maybe we'll get through it. When Rav Aaron passes away, unfortunately, it was left to yeshiva students to plan the funeral. At least that's how it's described. I know one of those yeshiva students, Jose Faur. Jose Faur, I don't know if he planned the funeral, but he was one of the people who carried the coffin of Rav Aaron Cutler. Professor Jose Faur, who moved far away from Lakewood in his later years from the Syrian community. But what happened was the funeral took place on the Lower East Side in one of the big shuls. And there's an article in Hapardes after the funeral condemning what occurred. First of all, they didn't ask certain great rabbis to speak. They didn't ask Rabbi Henkin. Even though Rabbi Henkin was very close to Rav Aaron and was close to his father-in-law. They didn't ask Rav Soloveitchik, even though Rav Soloveitchik helped Rav Aaron in many things. But more than that, the yeshiva students didn't consult with the Agudas Rabbanim. They planned it themselves. The reason why it was so scandalous is because, I mean, this Rivaron's a great figure, and many people wanted to come to the funeral. What they did was they shut the doors to the funeral and didn't allow, after they reached a certain level, and they refused to allow any more rabbis in. They said that yeshivas bachrim have to come in. So the scene was that, and I'll read you what it says in a pardes in a second, you had all these older rabbis, distinguished rabbis, left outside the shul, waiting for the funeral to end. Because as far as I know, they didn't have the technology in those days, or they certainly didn't have the video. I don't know if they could hear it, but they were left outside, and the yeshiva students went inside. I'll tell you in a second now what month this was, because I don't remember. It was in November, so it would be cold. And the yeshiva students claim that Rav Aharon is our father, and therefore all the yeshiva students who look up to Rav Aharon, who is Talmidim, they have to come, and they override, they trump the old rabbis, which I guess they have a point when they say that, but that in the rabbinic world, it doesn't work like that. We all know that the older rabbis, the distinguished rabbis, they go before the young yeshiva students. I mean, that's always the way it is, especially in that world. Even when they have events, like when the Aguda has their Daf Yomi celebration, you would think at the Daf Yomi celebration, who would be up there on the dais? The people who actually do Daf Yomi, the different Magidei Shiurim around the country, who every day are getting up and doing it. No, they don't put the Magidei Shiurim up there. The people who are up there are the older rabbis, the important figures who don't do Daf Yomi. But they're the ones up there. Hapardes wrote that as follows. What kind of yeshiva student could issue such a disgraceful order to only permit the entry of B'nai Torah and not Rabbanim? Is the honor due to the Rav less than that which the yeshiva student deserves? Hundreds of Rabbanim, among them Gaonim and giants of Torah, had to stand outside for hours. When they heard that the Rav Aharon had passed away and the funeral was on the Lower East Side, all the Rabbanim from all of New York, from Brooklyn, from Queens, from New Jersey, they all went to the Lower East Side, and they come to the shul, and they're not allowed to enter. Instead, these young yeshiva students, 18, 19-year-olds, they're being the ones entering. They were not allowed inside the synagogue, although there was room for another few hundred. If Rav Aharon had been alive, he would have been agitated by this desecration of the rabbinate. The arrangements for the funeral of this great man should not have been left in the hands of a few yeshiva young men. It should rather have been left to the leading Rabbanim, with whom Rav Aharon jointly worked for the strengthening of Torah and Judaism. That was, as I said, quite a scandal that they were turning away rabbis. Look, you can't let everyone in. I remember I was at the funeral of Soloveitchik, and the Maimonides school is not that big. So they set up a separate area where I was in the gym, or the lunchroom, I forget, this big room. Where they had the video screen and, that many people were there. But in the shul, and it might have even had outside the Maimonides shul, they probably set up chairs as well. I couldn't get in. They were at the door, and they were only letting in people, Bostonians, important members of the Maimonides community, older Bostonians, and important Rabbani. So you had the people who knew, let's say, the YU crowd and the Boston crowd. So when the plane landed and the bus came, so the rabbis from YU, when they came there, they all went in. I can only imagine what would have happened if they told all these rabbis who came up that they were not allowed to enter. A couple other things to mention about Rav Aharon. He has a famous booklet, which appears in Hebrew, but then was translated to English, How to Teach Torah. It's originally, really, it was in Yiddish, and in 1960 it was a talk he gave. And this is often quoted and referred to in order to show really the differences between modern Orthodox approaches to Tanakh study and the Haredi world. Although it's not all the Haredi world, it's not all the modern Orthodox world, but in generally, you have a trend. You find it in the Ramban, you find it in Hirsch, you find it in Sefer Raphael Hirsch. You find it today in the whole school they have in Herzog in the Gush, that when you study Tanakh and you study about biblical figures, you try to understand them realistically. And therefore, you will, and Hirsch has a whole piece about this, that the Torah does not shy away from mentioning the flaws and the faults of even great figures. So people will give a Devar Torah and they'll say that, that Yitzchak, let's say you could say he made a mistake because he didn't raise Esav properly. He raised Esav the way he raised Yaakov, and he should have known that every child has to be raised differently. This is something that Hirsch and the Ramban, that Hirsch says. But I mean, that sort of thing, you'll find people today feeling that they can call attention to certain flaws or faults of the great sages. And Rav Aaron said that that's a desecration of their memory, that the Ramban, he could do it because he's the Ramban. Hershey definitely would not have approved doing it, and obviously we cannot do it. So Rav Aaron speaks about how it is any flaws or faults that maybe they would have had are so beyond our comprehension, they're not faults. So this has become a strong, really a guiding principle for in the Haredi world how to interpret Tanakh, and a strong measure of criticism, how in the religious Zionist modern Orthodox world, they often feel that they can, that their attitude is that the Torah wants us to call attention to certain flaws so that we can learn from them. And according to the Pshat, the simple explanation, sometimes it's apparent. The stories of King David, why are they there if not to call attention to these problems? But Rav Aaron had a different perspective. And it's not just Rav Aaron's perspective. This was a big dispute in the state of Israel about 10 years ago. It's called the dispute about viewing Tanakh, what they call Begova Einayim, how you view Tanakh. Do you view them, these figures, like way above us or like on our level? And in the so-called Chardali world, this Rabbi Tao has published a number of booklets against the approach of Machon Herzog, which is attached to the Gush. I have to tell you, by the way, that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein himself was not a fan of the method of Tanakh studied in the Gush. But this is independent of the yeshiva, really. They do their own thing. I want to call your attention just to, in the time we have left, just a few other point things I just gathered. If I had time, I was going to do them. If I didn't have time, I could leave them. But since we have time, I'll tell you about them. You might find them of interest. Rav Aaron, we have oral traditions about various Piskei Halacha decisions of Rav Aaron Cutler. One of his major students, who really today is on the outs with Lakewood, was Rav Yitzchak Abadi. Rav Yitzchak Abadi comes to Lakewood in the 1950s. He's from Venezuela, and then he's from the Syrian community of Venezuela, and then he went to Ponevezh and Israel, and then he comes to Lakewood in the late 19 or mid or late 1950s, and he becomes very close to Rav Aaron, especially since the students who never went home for Shabbos, who were living far away from their homes, they would come to Rav Aaron's house. They would become very close to have Seder with him. So Rav Abadi becomes very close to Rav Aaron and very close to his son, Rav Schneir. If I'm not mistaken, Rav Schneir even walked him down the aisle at his wedding. Later on, Rav Abadi, because he's a Sephardi, I think, even though he's in the Lithuanian world, his focus was on practical halacha. So whereas everyone else is studying Kilpul and Lithuanian chakiras, he focused on Beis Yosef, and he became a great posek, and he becomes the posek of the yeshiva. By the way, he was the official posek of the Lakewood yeshiva. There's four Rosh yeshivas today in Lakewood, and they're all his students. However, he has a falling out, not so much with Rav Schneir, but with the Rebbetzin. The story is, if you speak to people from Lakewood, Rav Abadi was more important than Rav Schneir. Rav Schneir, remember, his father died young, and Rav Schneir had to succeed him as the Rosh Yeshiva. He didn't have that many years just learning. He had to immediately start raising money. And so he often was away from Lakewood, and Rav Abadi was able to get a big following. And every day, for instance, after Mincha, the lines they tell me would be out the door with questions, and he'd have a phone near his shtender in the Beis Medrash, and people would be calling day and night. And it got to the point where he was overshadowing Rav Schneir, the Rosh Yeshiva. In those days, he had one Rosh Yeshiva, and you can't have a situation where the posek of the yeshiva is overshadowing the Rosh Yeshiva. And the Rebbetzin apparently was very strong on this, and eventually there was a breaking point, and it became very ugly. And he leaves the yeshiva and goes to Israel, has a kollel, came back. He's living in Lakewood now, but it really has nothing to do with the yeshiva. And he had always had idiosyncratic halachic views. The website kashrut.org is from his children, and his position from the beginning always was, in a way, he's still living like he's in the 1950s. He always argued that it's not necessary to have a hashkachas. He doesn't believe in hashkachas. He thinks the ingredients are all you need. I didn't know I'd be speaking about him, so I didn't put his picture on the. But you can Google him. You can see it. Looks very frum with the long beard, etc. And he published some volumes of Responsa, and in it he records different things from Rav Aharon Cutler. Rav Abadi has some incredible leniencies and incredible stringencies, but everyone knows he's a great halachic scholar. In volume one of his book of Tshuvot Or Yitzchak, page 231, he deals with, do you need to check your books for your Pesach? We're coming up to Pesach. Do you have to go through your books and make sure there's no chametz? Some people avoid this, that they don't eat all year. All he says is that you don't need to check your books for chametz. Can you hear me now? Am I back? Okay. No, Ira G, not the author of Magen Badi. That's another Abadi. That's Matlub Abadi. Matlub Abadi is clean shaven. Doesn't, you know what I'm going to do here? Hold on a second. I see we're going to have the time. So I'm going to... What I'm going to do is I'm going to send a picture right now, and I will, I'm going to upload it on the fly here, and you'll see who I'm talking about. But, so what does he ask about certain, can you, hold on a second, I'm going to upload this picture, I just have to download it to the computer. And then we'll have it. Just bear with me a second. It's always good to see the figures you're looking at. Okay, now let me get rid of this. It's hard to imagine that the guy whose picture I'm going to show you now believes that you don't need to have hashkachas on products. There he is, Rav Yitzchak Abadi. All you need are the ingredients. But in any event, so he says you don't need to search for your books. And he said, I assume because the odds of that something being there is very unlikely, and anything is there is just a crumb, and crumbs are not significant. And then he says that I never saw Rav Aharon search through his books or clean them. He says, many years I shimashti, that is, I served him, and I was the one responsible, appointed for all matters of chametz and kashrus of Pesach, and I did everything according to what he told me, and he never said to do anything about searching, looking through books to see if you have chametz inside your books. And Rav Abadi doesn't say anything about not learning when you have the books. Remember, according to strict halacha, tiny little crumbs are not a problem. It has to be something that's edible. I found some other things that he meant. He quotes Rav Aharon in his book about, he says, let's say you come late to davening. Let's say a lot of people are showing up 9:30, 9:40 Shabbos morning, and you miss Pesukah de Zimra. What are you supposed to do? He's asked the question, until how long after davening can you make up the Pesukah de Zimra? The question is, let's say you don't complete it immediately after davening. So the questioners are assuming that immediately after davening, you should then do the things, Ashrei or Hallelukas, that you missed. But if you don't, how long do you have? And then he says, those who say that you're supposed to make up the Pesuk of the Zimra, you miss. He says, there's no time limit. He says, but in my opinion, what's the point? He says, there are those who say that you don't need to wait, make it up. So why make it up, since it's not an obligation? He says, Sheva Tase Adif. And he says, and Mori Varabi, Rav Aaron, Shedikdakti Masif Habe, I paid attention very carefully to his actions. He wouldn't make them up. So if Rav Aaron came in late, he didn't make it up. Or maybe if Rav Aaron was, had a lot, I know the Rav Herschel Schechter has said that he doesn't do a lot of these Pesukim of Zimra because the minyan he goes to in Washington Heights, they daven so fast, he can't keep up with them. So here we have him saying that you don't need to make it up, and Rav Aaron didn't believe that you need to make it up, and he didn't. He was asked about drinking wine outside the sukkah. We all know that you have to eat mezonos outside the sukkah, so what about wine? I don't know why it's such a question, because Shulchan Aruch says you don't, and he says the same thing. Rav Aaron, he said, so, but it's better. I mean, if you look online, you look at the various people who discuss it, they all say, quote the Shulchan Aruch, say you don't have to, but it's better to eat it in the sukkah. But he says that with Rav Aaron, we had a simple space to Shaweva. We were in the house, not in the sukkah. I don't know why they do it in the house, not a sukkah. But he says then that we would have fruit and drink wine. And if there was any question about eating in this, drinking wine in the sukkah, Rav Aaron wouldn't have given us wine. And one final thing, which I found here, I mentioned already, Rav Badi sometimes differs from Rav Aaron. He holds that you can eat gelatin. The last thing, this is not a big deal. I don't think either. He's asked about drink. This is Simon Lamed Hay, Volume 2. Drinking juice and everything before davening. And he says, there's not an issue. Fruit juice, whatever you want to. And Rav Aaron also said, there's not a problem. Rav Aaron has also entered the realm of the academic Jewish studies. In fact, there is an entire article. It appeared in the Yaakov Blitzstein Jubilee volume, Gerald Blitzstein Jubilee volume. Here it is. Gerald Blitzstein. Rav Soloveitchik said that he was his leading, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein said that Gerald Blitzstein was Rabbi Soloveitchik's most outstanding student ever. Of course, Gerald Blitzstein said that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was the most, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was the most outstanding student. But Gerald Blitzstein, who leaves America, goes to Ben-Gurion University, where he has a career of 35 years. He recently retired, maybe 40 years. And is the winner of the Pras Yisrael, the Israel Prize, really a great scholar of rabbinic literature, Talmudic, as well as medieval. So they gave him a very nice Jubilee volume. And in here, Menachem Kellner has an article called Harambam Shel HaRav Aaron Cutler. And basically, it's an analysis of how Rav Aaron Cutler views the Rambam in certain areas where the academic world diverges from him. For instance, Rav Aaron argues that according to the Rambam, all important theological matters have to be received by tradition. And Kellner points out that the Rambam says otherwise in the Mor Nevuchim, that some of the most important things he says through his own intellect. Rav Aaron cites the Rambam, a certain passage, how important the Torah scholars are, and that they're like the tribe of Levi, who are separate and special to the community. And Kellner argues that it's not referring to Torah scholars, it's referring to any individuals, including non-Jews, who want to devote themselves to God. And then Kellner discusses afterwards, what does this mean? Did Rav Aaron know the truth, and was he just being polemical? Or, and he concludes that Rav Aaron, because he had such a indoctrination in the yeshiva world, he views the Rambam through this without, looking at it from the outside. Objectively, I guess Kellner would say. I don't know if that's the answer. I think a more simple answer is, I don't know if Rav Aaron ever studied the Mor Nevuchim. So when you cite passages from the Guide for the Perplexed that contradict what Rav Aaron says, that could explain it. A famous example of this happened when Rav Shach came out with a statement. He has a famous speech in which he quotes the Rambam, who gave the distance, what he thought the distance from the earth to the sun was, and how big the sun is. And Rav Shach says, how would he know that? It must be he studied, learned it out from the Torah. And Rav Aharon Lichtenstein has an essay in which he says, what do you mean, how would he know it? The Rambam tells us in the guide how he knows it. He tells he got it from the Greek astronomers. So here you have an example of where if you don't know the guide for the perplexed, notice the guide for the perplexed illuminates the Mishneh Torah, and therefore we have errors by even great Torah scholars in explaining Maimonides because they're unaware of what he writes in the guide. By the same token, we have examples where academic scholars make mistakes because they don't understand or don't know things that the Rambam writes in his halachic writings. So you really need to combine the two, and that's, I think, the best way to understand it. I see it's already, time really flew, so it's already basically 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. So I'm going to take the questions, but before we do that, then I want to look. I'll read through the questions and comments. I know people made a lot of comments. Yes, and Heschel says that Menachem Kellner grew up in St. Louis. You know, Heschel, I didn't know he grew up there. I knew he lived there. I know he went to WashU. And thanks for telling me that. I knew Kellner lived in St. Louis. And he was a student there, a Schwarzschild, but I didn't know that he grew up there. So thanks for that. And his father was a rabbi, so he might have been in various places. But I want to, before I answer the questions, because in case any of you want to, those who are listening, you can't see you, but I see you. And most of the people listening are very quiet. They don't say anything. So I thank the people who do say things. And those who listen after the fact, I want to thank you all again for a very nice semester. Rabbi Kelman asked me to do Rav Aharon. So, you know, it took me a while to find the time, but I hope I did him justice, at least explaining his significance. And thank you all. As always, the questions and the comments you make are so important. So let me go back and just look at some of the... Maizmi about Velazhin, very nice. I don't just want to get some questions, though, that I can share with everyone. You say, Meiselman says, of the later conventions of the Aguda, how many there do you think opposed the proposed state for that reason? I don't think there was anyone at the Aguda who had really theological objections. I shouldn't say that. There were a couple. In the Apartis article, it mentions theological objections. And I said that I assume that that's referring to this Rabbi Rottenberg, who was Hungarian. But Rav Aharon and Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, in none of their writings do they have theological objections. Their objections to the state is always that the Zionists are going to control it. And that's the reason. And because of that, once it becomes a fait accompli, there's no reason to oppose it anymore. Listen, people from Meiselman, Meiselman has a quote from Rav Shach against democracy. They never liked democracy. They wish that they'd be in a society where the Torah leaders would make the decisions. But at the end of the day, if that's the society, that's what you deal with. Ira says, as a Galitz Yaner, he likes the Lithuanian pronunciation. I was listening closely, and I took in actually 80% of what he said. It's very hard to find the Lithuanian pronunciation today, so much so that young yeshiva students who try to show that they're from, many of them, they could have gone to, let's say, modern Orthodox schools, they go to Israel, so then they come back and you give them an aliyah, and they'll say things like Torah, Torah. They don't even know that that's not the Litvish pronunciation, that's the Polish pronunciation. If they want to be a Litvak, if they want to be like all the Gedolim that they're supposed to want to be, because they're coming from the Lithuanian yeshiva world, then they would say Tera. Heschel's listening here. I'm sure his grandfather said Tera. I mean, that's how a Litvak pronounced things. I heard I was in California not long ago, a couple months ago, and I haven't heard a Litvish pronunciation like that in a long time. The Chazan, everything was... all the O's were A, Tera, Das Tera, all these things. So I haven't heard that in so long, and very few people have it. Another thing is, though, the typical in some areas of Lithuania, they couldn't say shin in the Lithuanian pronunciation. They said sin, so they couldn't say Shabbos. They said Sabbos, which any of the older generation, if you remember Lithuanian Yiddish speakers, you might recall that. And again, I'm really sorry for they tried this new system, and when we broke apart, we're sorry about that. Meiselman makes a joke. No need for that Rav Soloveitchik's funeral. No need for the Rosh Yeshiva outside because they were absent. That is true. They did not come to the funeral. Ira mentions this Magen Baadi. There was a Syrian rabbi who was very important in the community. He was one of the two Syrian leading rabbis, him and Kassin. He was really at odds with Kassin. He was more liberal. His name was Matlub Abadi. He was a businessman, but he was also a great scholar, and he opposed the ban on conversions in the Syrian community. There are still people today in the Syrian community who look towards him. And he wrote the book Magen Baadi. He came from Israel. Abadi, Abadi, or Abady, is a very popular Syrian name. And Raskis H. Heschel tells us that Menachem Kellner and Professor Gerald Blitzstein, he says, was a counselor at Camp Mossad, which I did not know at all. The younger people listening will not even know what Camp Mossad was. Hillel Halkin wrote a memoir about 5 or 6 years ago in commentary about his time at Camp Mossad. Hillel Halkin's father, Abraham Halkin, was a great Hebraist and a professor at the seminary, and how it was a real Hebrew-speaking camp. I don't know if Heschel, you went to Mossad, and he talks about how they had to come up with names for in baseball, what to call things. There were three Mossads at one point, but they all disappeared. Either the people went. Orthodoxy went to the right, and Mossad really wasn't in line with that. Also, many of the best and the brightest from Mossad ended up following the ideology and moving to Israel. But a whole book was published in the 1980s about Mossad, and it was very important. So Heschel says that Kellner's father was principal of the Hebrew Academy. Very good. And Iris is Tera. Exactly. And Meiselman says that the Litvaks were far too cynical for any of today's frum types, and he's absolutely correct. Every good Litvak had some cynicism, and then in Lithuania they used to say a galich is frum. That is, a priest is frum, a yid is erlich, a Jew is erlich. This frumkeit, that was not them. And Ira says, I would appreciate a Rav Gorelick. I don't know. He might have thrown me out to the shir. And Heschel tells us that Rabbi Riskin was also a Mossad counselor, and you are a Mossad person. I think Heschel, in your day, there would only be one Mossad, right? Just one Mossad Aleph. I know eventually there was Mossad Bet and Mossad Gimel as well. I knew Louis Bernstein, who was very involved in Mossad, and there was someone in my town. Unfortunately, he's not well. But both him and his wife, Rabbi Shmuel Tokayer, and his wife Hani Tokayer. They were old Mossad people that you might remember, but Mossad, there were two in those days. Okay, I want to thank you all and wish you all. Meiselman, you have so many interesting comments and questions, but I think it's a little bit like inside baseball. Some of the things you're talking about, you and me are the only ones, we've spoken about these things. I don't think they have the broader appeal. So I'll have to leave some of them, but thank you especially for all your good questions and comments, Meiselman. And yes, he is of that Meiselman family, but I will leave it at that. I won't give you tell you how distant a relative he is from the famous Rabbi Meiselman. Thank you all again, and I wish you all a very good Pesach. And Heschel, thanks to you, I will be coming down to Mirza Hashem to St. Louis. And we'll have a wonderful Shabbos there and a wonderful community of which you are such an important part of. One more thing before I go, Heschel. Do you remember your grandfather, if he pronounced it Tera? Heschel's grandfather is Rabbi Geffen, the famous Rabbi Geffen from Atlanta. a Litvish Talmud Chacham, Rav, Posek, and famous for giving the Hashkacha, the first Hashkacha on Coca-Cola, the Coca-Cola rabbi. But yes, Meiselman, you knew it, Coca-Cola rabbi. So Heschel, you should be impressed that Meiselman knew. But I have to say, he's there's much more than just Coca-Cola. You can go and see his tshuvot online, and in preparation for Pesach, you can read the tshuva is about using Coke on Pesach. So it's good preparation for understanding the idea of kitnios and when it's butel and things like that. So that's famous Rabbi Geffen, who has numerous descendants all over the world, doing great stuff for Kol Yisrael. Good night, everyone.